Welcome to the A-Dub Club, a podcast about sci-fi, fantasy, technology, pop culture, the internet, and general nerdery. There are three things that are important to know. One, we occasionally use swear words, but try to stay in the range of PG-13, or at least the kind of R the cool parents are fine with. Two, we may talk spoilers. In this particular episode, we discuss Buffy the Vampire Slayer, seasons 1 and 2, and the movie Cabin in the Woods, so be warned. And finally, three, most importantly, Ryan Reynolds was originally in the running for the role of Xander, which... no disrespect to Nicholas Brendan, but, I mean, come on, can you imagine? With that out of the way, welcome to the clubhouse. We have snacks. Welcome to the A-Dub Club. I'm Andrew Whipple.
I'm Alex Wade.
And once in every generation, there is a podcast that will rise to defeat the evil. I wish I should have had it up and running to do a better blank check bit of it. But oh well. How are you doing, Alex Wade?
I'm doing all right. I got in a minor fender bender about an hour or two ago. I think it's gonna be fine though. It's gonna be great. Was my fault, I don't think, but we'll find out.
Insurance agents, this is not legally binding if you are listening to our podcast. I don't even know if that's how it works. But either way, nice. Well, nice that you're okay, and nice that you're probably not at fault in a way that is not legally binding one way or another.
How are you doing?
Yeah, you know, hanging in there, living that quarantine life. I drove to Wisconsin for a bit right before they put in the, if you spend more than 24 hours in Wisconsin, you need to do a 2-week quarantine if you get back to Chicago order, because apparently Wisconsin has a lot of COVID-19 cases. Mm. All things being equal, I probably am not in, this is probably not the third time that I think that I might have had COVID without actually proving it one way or another with a conclusive test. But I don't know. I guess we'll find out.
Yeah, you know, for some reason, any state that I like, I don't know where it is or like what it borders, I just assume is like a very far way away. It's like you went from Chicago to Wisconsin, and I'm like, oh my God, that's crazy. How'd you drive that far when it's just not that far, is it?
Real talk, in the week leading up to me deciding that I was going to take a day trip to Wisconsin and the week leading after it, I continually forget whether I went to Wisconsin or Michigan, because I cannot keep those two states straight in my head despite living in Chicago for 4 years. So
yeah,
good exactly. Midwesterner I am. But we are not here to talk about Midwestern geography, are we, Alex Wade?
No, we are not. We're here to talk about Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Buffy the Vampire Slayer, yes. And so I guess to do the whole bit, our question is, what did you think of the first two seasons of Buffy the Vampire Slayer?
Yeah. So this is my first time seeing it, and I certainly enjoyed it. Season one is a bit slow and a bit campy and a bit ridiculous at some points, and like definitely a product of its time, that's for sure. Season two definitely picked up a lot more, and like I could see leagues of improvements between the two seasons. The writing, for one thing, is just so much better.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Agreed. Yeah, so I started watching season one a year ago when I first noticed that it was on Hulu, and then kind of petered out. But I'm going to take a long way around to say this. The first time that I ever watched any Buffy was about 10 years ago. I had finished watching Firefly and loved it. It was the first time I'd ever seen it. And I guess at that point knew enough about Joss Whedon to know, like, I want to watch more of the kind of stuff that this guy makes.
Yes.
And so I decided I was going to watch the pilot of Buffy and the pilot of Dollhouse, and whichever one I liked more, I would continue watching.
Oh.
And of course, I hated the pilot of Buffy and loved the pilot of Dollhouse. Watched Dollhouse. It became a show that I really liked and watched throughout high school. The reason I'm bringing up that context is I think if I had, one, decided to watch Buffy instead, two, to your point, made it through the first season and got to the second season back in 2009, 2010, I think Buffy would probably have been my favorite TV show of all time.
Ooh, really?
I incredibly, incredibly loved this. As it stands right now, it's probably in my top 10, maybe top five. And one other thing, new piece of information to throw down on you. You made it through, what did you say, how far did you make it into the show?
I made it into season 3, episode 2. Finished up episode 2 last night.
Cool. I watched the whole show and then also rewatched about five episodes from season 1 and 2, in preparation for this episode. So
it's,
I watched
8 seasons long?
7 seasons. But the first season are 22 episodes. I think that means I watched about 140 something episodes of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. I think I mathed it out. It was over 5 full calendar days of doing nothing but sitting on the couch watching Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Okay.
So.
Props.
Needless to say, I am a fan, but I also entirely agree with you that season 1 is pretty bad, and I think it's why I mean, part of why I gave up close to the end of season 1 last year was because it timed up with The Bachelor coming back, and I'm not going to watch 4 hours of The Bachelor a week and then keep watching Buffy, but apparently I am willing to do nothing but watch Buffy, so that excuse is bullshit. But yeah, I fell off of it in season 1 because it's not very good. Season 2, however, very good.
Side note, I did know that you'd watch Dollhouse. I didn't think I knew anyone that's really watched Dollhouse. We should definitely talk about that later.
Interesting, because I remember, I think it was you, me, and Grace got getting into at least a conversation or two about the fact that the three of us watched Dollhouse.
Exactly. Like, whatever, so few people junior year. Watched it. It's a great show. Fantastic. I love it. Especially the ending. Oh, crazy.
I know. I haven't seen that in a decade. Yeah. I haven't seen it since it first was airing. So I am very interested in watching that, and Firefly for that matter. I haven't seen Firefly in probably like 8 years.
Should we just
really
like a Joss Whedon like rewatch thing? Like,
here's what I say. I would say yes, but maybe let's space them out. We'll put those on the backlog of does Dollhouse hold up and does Firefly hold up as
maybe that's going to be one of our reoccurring themes. Like, we have Star Wars and we'll have Joss Whedon TV shows. Like, that'll be the next thing to start.
I dig it. That works. That works.
But anyway, back to Buffy. Season 1. I want to parse between season 1 and season 2.
Totally.
Season 1 was so campy and definitely a product of its time, and felt like there were so many of these different stereotypes and characters that were just stereotype. Like, it felt like the acting was not great, and it felt like anyone could be in those positions. Am I kind of making sense?
And I think some of that is because, in addition to watching a lot of Buffy, I read a lot of the Buffy Wikipedia page.
I do have a theory why it feels that way, but keep going.
Okay, yeah, you could do your theory first before I give my theory.
Sure. So my theory is that Joss Whedon was very restricted and needed to appease a large audience, and just kind of went with turning the classic horror kind of theme movie stuff into a TV show. Like, it didn't feel like what I've seen Joss Whedon do before. Like, it didn't feel super creative. It didn't feel very varied. It felt just like all stereotypes in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I think that, and also I think the original this is from Wikipedia, and it's also like, you know, him saying this years after the fact, so grain of salt to all of it. But apparently the original pitch that he gave on doing the TV show, which itself was an adaptation of a movie that he wrote, which I also watched the movie. Movie's really bad, not worth watching. He actually walked away from the movie. Yeah, he walked away from the movie because he was so mad at how poorly it was being directed and performed. But his original pitch was the idea of like high school is hell, high school as a horror movie. And it was sort of built around this idea of like, let's turn the stereotypes of high school and of horror into metaphors for each other in ways that I think
interesting.
I totally agree with. In the first season, it's a lot clunkier and more obvious than the much, much more elegant ways that it does the same idea of like, let's take these parts of the the high school experience, the teen experience, and then make them a metaphor in the world of horror.
Yeah.
It is done much, much more elegantly in season two in, I think, bits that we can talk about later.
And also even in season one, like even in season two and three, they start making like meta jokes about the city and about how the cops in this town are fucking idiots that they haven't noticed anything. And it's like, such a ridiculous, there's so many ridiculous concepts of this whole TV show of like, oh, the entire school was taken over by, you know, nightmare dreams. And then like the next day, everything's fine. You know, it's like, it's not meant to be a realistic show, but like, I feel like it slowly started to become more realistic. It kind of starts taking itself a little bit more seriously in some ways and starts calling itself out. That I feel like it's just calling out season one, frankly. Like,
it's
like commenting on itself. That's how I feel about
it. Yeah, I could see that. I could see also, now that you're mentioning that, I not to say that I'm going to rewatch all of Buffy again, but I would be if I were to do that, I'd be interested to see if it's also some level of it takes the stuff that matters, in particular, like the interpersonal relationships and the psychological reality of the characters, more seriously, and then gets the and then counterpoints that by taking some of the like you're saying, the silly trappings of the world as silly, as treats them for the silly things that they are, while grounding in the actual characters and relationships and emotions.
Yeah, definitely.
Ooh, I guess we should assume that everyone has heard of Buffy the Vampire Slayer and is aware of the at least core premise of the show. But just in case, one, we'll definitely spoil everything up through everything Alex Wade has watched, or we probably will, I guess. That's happening in the future, so who can say? But two, but not anything beyond that, because I would not spoil that for Alex. He must go on that journey himself if he wants to. Premise. Sarah Michelle Gellar plays Buffy, who is a teenager who can hunt, is the mystical chosen slayer who can hunt vampires. Vampires exist. And she's in the high school in Sunnydale, California, a fictional sort of suburban-y town. She meets up with her new friends, Willow and Xander, who are two normies that help her out. Slayer duties, along with her watcher Rupert Giles, who's the stuffy British librarian, who's the best, and helps her out in her her slayerage, as well as a few other characters that in the very brief non-spoilery part before we start spoiling things, characters like Angel and Spike and Drusilla and other various interesting characters who she interacts with along her journeys.
And it's you know, it's a solid crew, and there is something that I want to mention of like Joss Whedon and horror, of also like Cabin in the Woods is a fantastic movie that is written and directed by Joss Whedon that is all about
is let me look it up. I don't remember if it's it is directed actually by Drew Goddard. And written by Drew Goddard and Joss Whedon. Drew Goddard himself was a writer on Buffy the Vampire Slayer, as well as a bunch of other Joss Whedon projects going forward.
Yeah, so the whole point of Cabin in the Woods is it's like a I don't want to say satire is the right word of horror movie. Maybe that is the right word.
I think that's the right word, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a satire of horror movies. And I actually had a friend who she wrote her like thesis on Cabin in the Woods.
Damn.
And
I would want to read that.
Yeah, me too. I need to ask her for it. And it's just talking. It's all an allegory. It's all a commentary on horror movies and on the different kinds of things that like you need to have and what you do and do not have. It's like, for example, the biggest thing that like pops out in my head is there's a scene where it's like super sexual. And they're out in the woods. This guy and girl, the jock and the whore, are their archetypes. And there's the security guard who's commenting on this, being like, do we really need to like be watching like these two people in the forest fuck right now? And it's like, we're not the only ones watching. And that's a commentary on like the audience. Like in the movie, they're talking about, you know, the gods and the demons who are watching, but they're also commenting on like the actual audience itself is watching. And in the context of like having just seen Cabin in the Woods pretty recently and then like watching the first season of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, it was very interesting because I could start to pick out all of these different tropes that were being used that like were just like easy to do, I don't know, run of the mill tropes kind of to produce, if that makes sense. That didn't take, I don't want to say didn't take like creative energy and skill, but like kind of.
Any particular illustrative example of that in your head?
Sure. So like Cordelia, the ditzy popular blonde who always finds herself like getting like the short end of the stick sometimes when it comes to any horror situation that's happening, right? Mm-hmm. So like there's a direct scene where there's a ghost person who she wants to cut Cordelia's face up, and like as the audience you're like she's like kind of deserves it. Although I feel like this is not a good specific example because it's an example of like the audience being on Cordelia's side for once. But even during the first season, Cordelia is like kind of the not the anti-hero. That's not the right word. Like definitely a villain.
She's sort of the at school antagonist of Buffy and the crew of like they're all the weird nerds that are off fighting vampires and hanging out in the library, and she's the popular girl who makes
popular life hot girl. Very important. Yeah. I do want to say like her being hot is a important part of her feature, like because especially in the terms of watching the Cabin in the Woods, you know, the quote unquote whore is the stereotype there. It's like, oh, that's the one who dies first, that's the one who you're not rooting for, is kind of the gist of it over there. I feel like I might be maybe too much analyticalizing it and not maybe not necessarily getting the right message, but somewhere in that realm.
And I think that there's the interesting blend of this show being a mix of clearly very inspired by horror and horror tropes, clearly very inspired by high school TV shows and high school. Oh, interesting. I guess that's also true on the superhero front.
Yeah.
But I was saying in the case of Cordelia, it's that she partly fills the role of the ditzy girl that gets killed in the horror movie, partly also fills the role of the mean girl in the high school TV show.
George,
And then later on in the show fulfills the role of one of my favorite characters.
Interesting. I'm very curious because like season two, she's like still ditzy, but she's like she's not the antagonist anymore. Like she's on your side. She's on Buffy's side. And like she's friends with them for some reason.
It starts in season two is where I started to like her, especially because I think she gets to be written in season two more of like you get to see more of the not the cracks necessarily, but it's like the jokes she makes start to become actually funny. She has a couple moments of like there is some vulnerability there that you get the sense that there's some degree that Cordelia that we see is a character that is played by Cordelia, the real character. And then to that point, she joins the team, and also from the minute that her and Xander started having any hint of chemistry, I was like, "Ooh, I really hope that they end up getting together because that would be fun." And I didn't like Xander and Willow together.
Yeah, anyway. I didn't like Xander in Willow together. I don't like Xander and Buffy together, and like Xander and Cordelia. It's interesting because like they haven't like it makes sense kind of, but they also haven't justified it in the show. Like,
I mean, they are. It's that weird thing where they kind of are that kind of couple that makes more sense in real life than it does in TV, where it's like, oh yeah, two people that like are around each other a lot and are attracted to each other and are snippy towards each other and like, and especially when they're hormonal teens, it's like, okay. It's not a huge leap of logic to assume that it's mostly that like they're hormonal, they're hanging out together a lot and they're alone and they are kind of self-destructive and they hook up. In the context of fiction, it's a little weird. It's not the kind of thing that happens without greater justification usually.
It's a bit odd, and like I'm glad it's there so that Xander can stop being the like trying to get with Buffy person.
And
Willow can stop like pining after him, you know, like,
yeah,
those are both very stereotypical things that in the first season that I was like upset about. It was like just frustrating of like, oh, this boy only sees this girl as a hot piece of ass who that's why the main reason why Xander's into Buffy. And then Willow, the forever like snubbed character in season one. And then season two, she starts slowly becoming like a badass. And I'm like, I'm very excited for the arc. Like the thing about season one is I feel like they realized they fucked up so many things. And that was where they started. Like that's all mm-hmm. it was a starting point. And now the characters actually have some sort of depth because yeah. they started out as these archetypes. And then the writers, I guess, I don't know, got bored with those archetypes and were like, we need growth, you know?
Yeah, interesting, because I haven't rewatched season one overall, but I did rewatch the pilot specifically just because it had been a year since I had seen it. And I figured, okay, if we're going to talk about the first two seasons, I should sure. remember what actually happens in the pilot. Also, I had finished Buffy the Vampire Slayer after spending nothing but all of my time over the last 7 weeks watching Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and I wanted to watch more Buffy the Vampire Slayer. But in rewatching the pilot, it was interesting in that context of like brain dumping 140 episodes of this show directly into my cerebral cortex, that there was, I agree with you that a lot of the depth is missing. Maybe it's just me pattern matching and ignoring the stuff that doesn't fit, but there definitely are hints of the things that I love about these characters later on that are flashing there even from the first episode. Though I do agree, because I watched the pilot and then also watched a couple of key season two episodes that I like a lot. And it was much more so in those later season two episodes than it was in the pilot.
Yeah. I also do want to talk about the main villain in season one of like the master.
Yeah.
And it was, he's just evil. Like, yeah. There are a lot of characters in this show that are just evil, but like even Angel, after he turns back into being evil, like is also, first off, I love evil Angel more.
Me too. Like,
more than like, oh, little soft-hearted, like compassionate Angel who's like hesitant
I have a soft spot for Angel in comparison to a friend of mine, Benina, who was mercilessly dunking on me for saying I kind of liked Angel as a character. And so I think I have more of a soft spot for him than most people do. But I 100% agree with you that like Angelus compared to Angel.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Come on. Like,
even just like on from a purely acting perspective, first off.
Yeah.
Is just so much better.
Which made me kind of – it was – because, like, I liked Angel. I think I liked him more as a – one, as a function. I liked the function he played in the show.
Yeah, absolutely.
So in the performance. And, again, I also watched a lot of Bones when I was in middle and high school, so I have a soft spot for David Boreanaz. But I was totally like, it's fine, the performance. Until then, Angelus is so fun. And this is the thing that I do love about the show is that because this happens a lot where you get to see, because it's a vampire show, you get to see characters as their real versions and their vampire versions. And I do like that even in the case of Angelus, it's like there's it makes sense as an extension of Angel. It's not a completely different character. It is a, here's all the bad habits of Angel. Now they're brought to the forefront and given rein to go crazy. Yeah. It almost made me then wonder about the Angel performance. And I was like, okay, so clearly David Boreanaz is a good actor. He's capable of doing good performances. So it kind of retroactively made me like his Angel performance more. Once in my head, I was like, I guess it's a choice. It's not just that he's bad and bad at being on camera.
Yeah. I think it was a direction thing, probably. Yeah. Like, Oh, Angel's is so much better.
And oh, like, totally.
Also what I love is the sense of guilt that he has as Angel, and like hatred of himself is very apparent versus in Angelus. Like it shows in his actions as Angelus, like,
yeah.
And what he does is it's all rooted in him hating his humanity. Like,
yeah. Yeah.
And he even says that a couple times, like he hates feeling human, like, yeah, and, I love it.
Yeah, and the fact that like Angel's whole big thing is that like he's a weird stalker, but he's a sensitive, helpful weird stalker. And then when he's Angelus, it's like, oh, he's a weird stalker that will drive people insane in order to torture them before he turns them into vampires. Related to one of my other favorite characters in the entire show, motherfucking Drusilla. Drusilla. Oh my God.
So here's
Julia Landau, my gal. It is one of the single weirdest performances I've ever seen committed to screen, and I love it.
It's fantastic. Like, my first introduction to her was, I think she came in season two, right?
She's in season two, and I think she's in, like, episode three of season two is when her and Spike are introduced, I want to say.
Pre-recovered Drew, so when she was, like, you know, diminutive and, you know, she was weak still. There was a bit too much of the, like, the babying and the, I don't know, the sexual, like, how do I describe this? I want to get this right.
I don't know. How do you?
Without saying something horrible. like the
There's
the,
always the option to edit.
Yes. I will rely heavily on that. I want to say the sexualization of young characters and of childlike demeanors. So
yeah,
the thing, she was like, she's got that baby girl sexy thing going on that I did not like, that was like creepy and made me feel like Spike is almost a sexual predator. Mm. And that kind of feeling, you know?
Yeah. 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 No, I can see that. I wasn't as bothered by it, partly because I was kind of reading it as more of less babyish and more Victorian waif kind of thing.
Sure.
Or which I think both are kind of present in there. And I think also partly because I was, however uncomfortable I was made by it, kind of worked in the context of, well, Spike's
sure, yeah.
a jerk. Spike sucks. Oh, well, Spike sucks, nope. But then becomes better, both as a character and as a plot function. But yeah, no, I think that's totally fair, a fair critique.
I also do want to point out the obvious thing that I can't believe we haven't talked about, Angel and fucking Angel and Buffy, like for 300-year-old or 200, whatever.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
And 16-year-old girl.
It helps that this is one of those cases where I'm so glad that everyone looks like they're in their 30s on this
thank
show.
Thank God, yes.
That every single high schooler, like they all look exactly the same age, and that age is like 32.
Yeah.
Especially Xander. Like, Xander looks like he's like 30. Like, Xander's got a receding hairline from episode one.
yeah.
It's the kind of thing you really don't want to think too much about, given how much the show leans on the relationship between Buffy and Angel.
Yeah, I'm like, this is one of those times when we need to mention, you know, two straight white guys.
for sure.
Commenting on this, but like, is what are the ethics of dating as a vampire? Like,
I mean, I think there's a couple. There's on the one hand, there's the ethics of the, hey, you're going to live forever and you're going to watch them grow old and die, and that's very upsetting for everyone. There's
sure.
that.
I think that's a choice, you know?
That's a choice, but if people can get into it consensually, whatever, fine. Then there's the thing of anybody that is not a high schooler dating a high schooler, whether they're – because that's also – here's the other thing. It's like it is even commented on despite the fact that they both look like the same age because they're all adults being cast in teen roles, which again, glad that they did. The like, it's even within the context of the show, they are still commenting on like, oh, Angel is look, quote unquote, looks older than Buffy. They assume he's in his 20s and hooking up with a high schooler, which is still bad. Even if he wasn't a 300-year-old vampire, it would still be bad to be a like 20 something or 30 something that's hooking up with a high schooler.
Oh God,
it's not great. It's not great. And it is, unfortunately, Not the slight spoilers. It does not stop this kind of thing that you should not think too hard about, or rather,
sexual politics that work best if you try not to think about them through any sort of modern lens or really any critical thinking lens at all. Continues throughout all seven seasons of the show, unfortunately.
Also, I do gotta say the whole sex between Buffy and Angel and that whole episode of it just felt so gross. Like, is this something we're gonna do? And like, I don't know. The metaphor of having sex turned him evil. And I know it's because it was a moment of pure happiness, which is also just there's so much about it that like I can't even begin to get into it. Like,
I am so excited though that you have begun to get into it, because the two-parter Innocence is the second episode. Let me pull up my cheat sheet of Buffy episodes. Surprise is the one where Buffy and Angel hook up, and Innocence is the episode right after that where it's, you know, Angel leaves in the middle of the night and then he loses his soul and then they find out about that and all hell breaks loose. Innocence is one of my favorite episodes of the entire show. This whole arc is one of my favorite arcs. And I think I totally see where you're coming from. I think, and I'm curious, the framing that I had from it was less the framing around like, oh, Buffy having sex turned him evil. Less of that and more as the metaphor for the, you lose your virginity to someone who turns out to be an asshole. A metaphor for that experience, the experience of like, oh, you give it up to a guy and then the guy turns out to have like is a jerk to you, in which case it was less that reading to me then made it feel less gross, or rather gross in the way that fully supported it in it being a like, this is a thing that makes, it's a trial for Buffy to go through, to have to deal with deal more with Angel being bad. I read it in a way that both me and my read of the show didn't put any blame on Buffy for anything she did.
I'd like to take back what I said about her having sex, you know, turned him evil, and like that's weird and gross. I don't think that specifically. I think what I was saying more was gross was just the whole episode surrounding it and the way how sex was treated and how it was like, it just felt very weird. And I remember my feelings about it. I don't remember the episode too well distinctly, unfortunately. So I'm trying to grasp at those, what they were, but
I kind of in the same way, because I rewatched. So the five that I rewatched was, I rewatched the two-part season one series pilot, and then I rewatched Innocence, so the one after they have sex and Angel turns, and I watched the two-part finale of season two. But I didn't watch the episode where they actually have sex, so I'm in that same boat of not 100% remembering how it went, only to know that I didn't love that episode nearly as much as I loved. Like, again, Innocence is one of my favorite episodes of the whole show. And on my list that I made in a spreadsheet that has tracking all my favorite episodes, that one, the surprise, doesn't even rank anywhere close. It's like a nothing middle of the pack episode.
Yeah, that's I remember feeling weird about the way how sex was handled throughout most of it, frankly. It was made in 1996 or something, so like, product of its time and everything. Then there's like the frat episode.
It was
very gross for a lot of reasons. And like,
it is interesting for, especially in my case, as someone who like Buffy, I do feel confident now saying Buffy is one of my at least top 10, if not top 5 favorite shows I've ever seen. But what I was going to say is that even within that, like, for as much as I love the show, oh my God, there are so many abjectly terrible episodes of this show.
Yeah.
There's a lot of times when this show is just actively bad. And again, not to spoil
season
things.
Season one was
like,
hard to get through. Like,
I think season one is one of my least favorite seasons, and it has more bad episodes. Like, the overall quality in terms of like the number of bad episodes to the number of good episodes is pretty low. The absolute abject worst episodes are later in the show, unfortunately, but they're in better seasons. So, you know, sure. it kind of balances out. But yeah, there is like the praying mantis episode is terrible. The hyenas episode is terrible. The internet demon episode is terrible. The reptile frat is terrible. The swim. I kind of have a weird soft spot for the swim team episode, and I don't fully know why.
That one's all right.
But it's okay. Same thing with like the evil egg one. I think only because the evil eggs are just like so gross that I'm like, this is kind of cool how gross it is, even if the episode's mostly boring. But
yeah, I do want to mention is especially in season two, and in season the two episodes I've seen in season three so far, is they definitely aren't afraid to like do different things and surprise expectations. Like I my best example of that I think is the robot that the mom was dating.
Yes. Ted, the robot dad.
Yes. So there was an episode where Buffy's mom, who's a single mother, starts dating this new guy, and like he's great, except one time like he tells off Buffy, and turns out he's like not too great a guy apparently. Turns out he's a robot. Turns out he was made in like the 50s by some guy to like keep his wife company, and then she died, and then this robot keeps like seducing women and then killing them, basically. First off, that concept is a bit interesting, but something I was surprised about was when he came back. Like so Buffy kills him, like accidentally pushes him down the stairs once because he starts to beat her. He starts to hit her, and she's being a fucking badass Buffy, fights back. And like that, first off, that alone,
she has literal super strength.
Yeah, like you knew that was coming, but also like that's not a common the common theme of that story of like, oh, there's the new bad boyfriend who is great to the mom but like evil to the children. That is a common, you know, stereotype or I feel like archetypal kind of story that like, you know, it had to be confounded because Buffy's badass. I didn't expect it to be straight up like, oh, she kills him. Yeah, and I was like two things. First off, I wish they had gone either they had gone farther and turns out she just killed him and he was a normal guy and like she just accidentally killed a dude. Like that would have been insane.
I feel the exact same way. That was my exact same thought towards the end of it.
Yeah. Like that would have been so cool to do, to like show her like her actions have consequences and like sometimes she can fuck up. But like I also do like the way how they went with it.
Yeah. And I do think it says something about the show that like both of us were in the position to think that was like we didn't necessarily think that she's going to kill the guy. But
no,
once
I was surprised.
Once she did kill the guy, we both like it would have been it like it says a lot about this show that like once she did that, one, that didn't make us completely like want to shut off our TVs and be like, well, fuck this show. And two, the fact that we thought it's entirely possible that maybe the end of this episode is that Buffy has to deal with the fact she killed an innocent person, or not an innocent person, but a non-demon person.
Yeah. I mean, I would qualify as innocent. Like, even if he's a bad dude who's like threatening to beat her, that not killing that person is
sure.
Yeah.
But I think, it speaks well to the show that like, if it had us hooked enough and believing enough in the show and invested enough in the characters that we would have been willing to make that journey if that was the way it decided to go.
Yeah. And that it feels like that kind of show, and especially in like season at the end of season two, I honestly, I don't know what I expected.
Yeah.
Like, but I did not expect that. And so the end of season two, Willow is trying to put the soul back into Angel, and she succeeds just as like the portal to hell opens, and Buffy like sees that it's really Angel who's back, and then she stabs him because the only way to close the portal is by using his blood to close the portal. I don't even know.
It is such an astonishing episode of television.
Yeah, that it is amazing. Finale.
This could be totally stealing a bit from, I think, Emily Vanderwerf on Vox. I also read a couple of these, like, ranking the all episodes of Buffy, including one written by a person who I know on Twitter, Louis Peitzman, who used to work for BuzzFeed. And his ranking is good. But I think it was in the Emily Vanderwerf one from Vox that was describing the ending of Becoming as, like, it's one of those rare examples where it's a lose-lose situation that every step along that makes perfect sense that we were able to get to there, where it's, oh, we've already seen that Willow is really stubborn and really wants to try and help and is really into doing magic and really confident in it. So she's going to, you know, come hell or high water, she's going to try and bring it back. We've already seen that Xander, justifiably, because he's never liked Angel, but also is very shooken by the fact that Angel murdered one of their friends, is willing to say, to lie to Buffy and say, yeah, you know what? She's, you know, kick his ass, I think is what he says.
Yeah.
And it makes perfect sense that, like, Buffy and Angel would fight. And then, like, that timing all makes sense and works with the way the episode works. And it gets to that point where, like, you're on the edge. Well, I'm not going to say you're. I was on the edge of all up until the very last moment of I could see Buffy refusing to kill him, but only if she could come up with some clever situation out of it. She would never just, like, sacrifice the world for it. And then there is no clever situation. And so she kills him right after he becomes human and then is emotionally destroyed by it. And it's just like, it's unbelievable.
That was heart-wrenching. I think I cried when that happened. I'm pretty sure I cried. Like,
totally.
God. I'm like, so I had talked to you about this before. So originally we were going to do this episode at the end of season one. And then I watched the first episode of season two, and just that one episode was, like, enough for me to say, I need to see season two before we do this review, because, like, I was going to give a bad review of season one. I was just going to be like,
totally.
I don't know. This is a bad show. I don't know why everyone loves it so much.
And at that point I was going to give a bad review of season one and then a good review of seasons two through four, which I had seen at that point.
Yeah. And that, like, well, even now, like,
good review of seasons two and three.
I had mentioned to you, Whipple, that, like, maybe we should do that again. Maybe we should postpone so I can see season three now. Like, season three even started with some really good stuff. Like, I've seen two episodes, and the second episode, it's like, first episode, Buffy has gone for the summer and she's, like, justifiably upset over the fact that she killed her boyfriend and, like, wants to escape life for a second, slayerhood, you know? The stress became too much because she did this horrible, awful thing that she couldn't help but do. But season two, when they're all pissed at her from coming back and like, just piling and piling on her. And it was like, and it was so real. And it was like, it was not, the archetypes were gone. And I saw the characters, and, like, Xander was no longer just this goofy motherfucker who says funny quips. And he, you know, it was a good episode. It was a great episode.
Yeah. You got to keep watching season three, because you haven't even gotten the arrival of one of the best characters in the show.
I kept accidentally clicking on episodes a season or two ahead trying to watch the next one. And I'd watch, like, 2 or 3 seconds of it. And, like, just – I could tell alone from those seconds that the quality was, like, dramatically better from season to season.
We have not talked about – I think the – in rewatching the – I think by season two, everyone is pretty good. Even, like, Xander gets better as the show goes on. But, like, even Xander is, like, pretty also solid and good. Good. Yeah, Seth Green's fun.
Talk to them about him for a second. But
yeah. But what I was going to say is, in watching the pilot, even though I liked Sarah Michelle Gellar a lot, I love her as Buffy overall, and I liked her in the pilot, it definitely felt like, okay, I know she's going to grow later on. The only and same thing with Anthony Head as Giles is like, oh, he's a little bit more sort of like frazzly bumpkin-y, whatever, versus the Giles that I know and love later. Willow is Allison Hannigan as Willow is the one from the very beginning that I'm like, oh, I love this performance of this character. And
she's fantastic.
Again, she does get better even, or not necessarily she gets better, but the character does deepen as the show goes on. And as in season two, she starts to get more in tune with, like, learning magic and all that fun stuff, moves away from being the computer nerd and more into the magic nerd, I guess. But, like, from the beginning, she was the one in that pilot that on rewatch that I was like, oh, you are shining in a way that the other actors aren't yet.
Her and Giles are absolutely the best, like, foundational characters, and like are very, I feel they were not archetypes. They were like, they had some archetypal things about them, but like they felt defined for me from season one.
Yeah. Do you want to know a fun casting story from with regards to Willow in particular, which is pulled from the Wikipedia page, because that's mostly what I've been reading. But apparently there was the let me open up the Wikipedia page. But there was when they were casting for the role of Willow, there was a particular moment. I think it's in the pilot. Where Willow sadly tells Buffy that her Barbie doll was taken from her as a child. Buffy asks if she ever got it back. Willow's line to reply was, "Most of it." Everybody else did that line as like, "Oh, did you ever get it back? Most of it." And then Hannigan, what she did was she come in and is like, "Did you ever get it back?" And she's like, "Most of it." Like totally upbeat, chipper, happy. And just reading that one thing, I was like, "Oh yeah, that's Willow. That is like unique and different." And like
sadly optimistic,
she's real, especially in those early episodes. She's very accepting of the fact that she's the weirdo and like doesn't try to pretend that she isn't on the bottom of the social totem pole, but is also sunny and chipper while doing that, and she's great.
Yeah, she's fantastic. What else about the show?
I mean, a thing that I at least want to touch on, I kind of touched on it a little bit, was the unbelievable level of, like, unbelievably influential this television program is in like, at least on my side, both thinking about, like, oh, two of my favorite shows of all time, Doctor Who and Veronica Mars, are so, so, so clearly indebted to Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Veronica Mars, in that it's like, oh, it's a bubbly or a quippy, but brash blonde high schooler who goes and gets into trouble while trying to help people in Veronica Mars' case is that she's a private eye, in Buffy's that she fights vampires in a California suburban town that is darker than it seems. And then Doctor Who, I think in particular, I was looking into this, it was called out explicitly as an influence. Like they tried to like, let's remake Doctor Who more like Buffy was kind of the pitch behind it. But in particular, the like, if I'm thinking of what are shows that blend being sort of a soap opera, but also being about real emotions, but also being a swashbuckling adventure and mixing sci-fi and horror and fantasy all together and doing it in like a relatively breezy but surprisingly emotional television show. And from a structural perspective of like X-Files, I think had done this first, but I think Buffy does it a little better of mixing the, you have your Monsters of the Week episode, but you also have a season-long arc that is tying towards some greater big bad. But like looking at like the first seasons of Doctor Who, it's, oh, the structure is identical to the structure of a Buffy season.
Yeah, that's for sure. It's very good. They're both great shows.
They are indeed. But I think I'm also just like across the board, like name a sci-fi show of the last 20 years, name a teen show of the last 20 years. This is not going to happen until season six, but like Buffy popularized the idea of doing a musical episode, which like so many shows have done since then. Yeah. Oh God. That was also the only other episode that I had watched before seeing this run through was when I was at LeakyCon in 2013, I did go to a sing along panel of the season six Buffy musical episode.
What the fuck?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
I guess I'm seeing at least through season six now.
Yeah. This, I guess, is a little bit of a spoiler, but I feel okay saying it. The premise is that there is a demon that comes to Sunnydale that makes everyone have to start.
Oh, my God. That's hilarious. I love that.
But the one other thing that I do have a note that I want to walk through is beyond just Buffy being influential in terms of like it influencing what TV shows look, especially genre TV shows, function like in the last 20 years. Here is a probably incomplete list of all of the TV shows and movies that Buffy writing staff worked on or created.
Oh.
Private Practice, Glee, Sharp Objects, Unreal, Grey's Anatomy, the 2011 Fright Night movie, Alias, Lost, The Good Place, Cabin in the Woods, Smallville, Spartacus, Daredevil, Gilmore Girls, 90210, Battlestar Galactica, Caprica, The OC, Torchwood, Once Upon a Time, Jessica Jones, Game of Thrones, 24, Fringe, Hannibal, The Tick, Arrow, Dexter, The Clone Wars, Warehouse 13, and Grimm. And if you include people who wrote only on Angel, the spinoff of Buffy centers on Angel, American Horror Story, Feud, Rome, Burn Notice, The Nine Lives of Chloe King, The Shield, Lie to Me, and Supernatural.
Okay.
So Buffy writing staff alumni, like basically everyone who wrote on Buffy wrote on or created multiple other shows that have been like the biggest shows of the last 20 years.
That's amazing. Like I'm very glad that I've finally fucking invested into watching this show.
And that's it's not even counting Joss Whedon himself, who it's like he does Buffy the Vampire Slayer and then goes off to do Firefly, Dollhouse, The Avengers.
Two of The Avengers, right?
Two of The Avengers, Dr. Horrible. Caveat that I do want to say on all of the talking about Joss Whedon is that apparently Joss Whedon is kind of a not great guy, not great to work with, and various people in particular, like he wrote off Charisma Carpenter from Angel when she was like pregnant because they got in a fight, and like kind of like open question as to whether or not that was pregnancy discrimination. He also like virulently cheated on and gaslit his ex-wives. A lot of people seem to not think Joss Whedon is a very good guy. And I think there's also some valid criticisms. There is some valid criticisms around like Joss Whedon as quote unquote feminist icon, where the version of feminism that his shows have is sort of the Buffy mold around like, well, let's have a girl just be super badass. I think it's a little deeper than that in the case of Buffy specifically, but like it's a similar critique that happens with Aaron Sorkin of like he kind of writes one or two kinds of women over and over again. I'm kind of see both sides of, and especially I'm kind of willing to give credit in the case of Buffy specifically, both because I think her character gets deepened a lot as the show goes on, and also in the 90s. But I wanted to throw those all out to say that like, you know, hey, Joss Whedon. Yeah. We want to like, I don't want to just be saying Joss Whedon's great. Joss Whedon's great. Joss Whedon's great.
Sure. Absolutely. And I'm totally on board with fuck Joss Whedon in a lot of ways. I get that. And I need to do more research, I guess, to fully define my opinion on him. But my first instinct is boo Joss Whedon.
Yeah. And hey, if you want to have more like listen to more discussions on the complexities of liking very great art, like I would say Buffy the Vampire Slayer is, from potentially shitty people, you can listen to our episode from a couple years ago called, I believe it's called Allegedly, where we in fact discuss that exact question. I also think that's one of the better episodes of our show.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a great topic too, and it's very relevant to life right now, and like how we should everyone should be looking to us for guidance on how to handle everything, you know?
That's exactly. Spoiler alert, the answer to that episode was we are the arbiters of whether a person is canceled or not.
Exactly. With sole arbiters and two straight white men, those are the only people's opinions that matters, you know?
Indeed.
And I just got canceled.
Indeed. Yeah. On that topic, there's an interesting discussion, I think, to be had about to what degree is Buffy the Vampire Slayer or Buffy the character a feminist show or character. And I think it's something that we could theoretically have. I don't think it's something that we should, given that we're already an hour into this. You're going to have to go to D&D at some point soon. And like that of all conversations is one that like we can fumble around and to little benefit to anyone else. No one's going to get any benefit out of listening to us discuss that, I guess.
I think that'd be, well, maybe not an interesting episode, but something for us to talk about more is like the Trinity Complex. And,
ooh, what do you mean?
Oh, well, that's the name of that kind of character. Is so like, you know, Trinity from the Matrix of like the badass female.
Got it. Yes.
So like that's a lot of issues that female protagonists have of like all they are is a badass and strong female lead is this person who can kick everyone's ass, you know, which it has its own set of problems. And like, you know, a lot of people are like, but wait, that's like making strong female characters is good for feminism, right? But it's a lot more complicated than that. Surprise, surprise.
Yeah. And I guess to my two sentence version of my thought on Buffy is that I think there's elements of it that fall into that trope a lot. A benefit, though, is that Buffy's femininity is never seen as a weakness in the show, and it's never treated as a weakness. It's treated as a vital and integral part of her character. And I think that helps
deal
with that complaint.
Season one, absolutely. Like that was her stereotype in season one that I was, coming against or grading against, was like, oh, she's badass female character is all Buffy is, and who goes out and kills things and can do gymnastics and is really strong, and like that's the entirety of what Buffy is. And in fact, in her name it has the word buff in it, because gotta be reminded that she's strong. But yeah, feminism, it's a crazy thing, you know.
Yeah, we are in favor of it. Feminism gets the official A-Dub Club seal of approval.
You got it. That's what it needed till now.
Exactly. Problems have been solved. Any other things that you want to talk about in the world of Buffy the Vampire Slayer seasons 1 and 2 and the first 2 episodes of season 3?
No, I'm excited to keep watching it and see where it goes.
Yeah, so you're definitely going to keep watching?
Absolutely. Like I started season 3 and it was just, there was some writing in the first episode that, like, they were in high school and they were going from scene to scene very seamlessly. It's like just a really well done shot of like having all the conversations and weaving them in between each other. And like the comedy and the writing was just all very well done. And it's like, this is the difference between another season of Buffy. It just immediately stepped up its game. Like, yeah.
Nice. I'm trying to think, is there anything else I want to talk about? I guess the one thing that I will throw down, because we did talk about Willow, we talked about Xander, we talked about Giles briefly as Giles rules, but Giles rules. The one, I guess, other thing I'll throw on Giles is that, like, I do really like, and I think this deepens a lot in season 2 and then only continues from there, is the relationship between Giles and Buffy is a total bedrock of the show.
Absolutely.
For me, at least. And God, his performance is so good.
Yeah. Jenny, I was really surprised when Jenny died. Like, I did not expect that. Like,
ooh, yeah, yeah.
That was also, I love Jenny. I loved Jenny, but she's dead now.
Yeah. I like Jenny a lot. And I also, I didn't rewatch the episode where she dies, but if there's like 2 or 3 images, single images from the show that like have stayed burned in my head, like I can exactly picture how it looks. And Angel killing Jenny, that tableau is like,
absolutely.
Oh, that's filmmaking right there. You created an image that is never going to leave my head.
Yeah. Also, just the computer science, which is like, it resonates with me so much personally as well. Like,
nice. Yeah.
Ah.
And then the one thing that I do also want to call out is that, like, I do really love and really vibe with the character of Buffy in particular. This is the rare show for me where I think my favorite character is the main character, which almost never happens when I watch TV.
Yeah.
In any other world, it would be like the Willow character or the Giles character that it's like, yeah, this is my favorite. But man, I like. Buffy is deep and complex enough and enough the center of the story. And Sarah Michelle Gellar's performance is really, really good, especially after you get through the early episodes of season 1, that
I do love it.
It really works for me.
She's fantastic. And like, I also do want to make a comparison here of, you haven't seen this, but in Legend of Korra, there's the main character in there who, she gets a lot of shit in that show. In the show, but also from like the fans of the show, that she's makes a lot of wrong decisions and keeps fucking up. And like, I think I personally disagree with, but I understand where people are coming from in that show. And like that, it kind of resonates a little bit in this show. Like, she fucks up a lot, but it's she does learn and she does improve, is something that I really like.
Yeah. Buffy is given the strength of her as a character and the writing towards her is that she gets to make, like you're saying, she gets to make those mistakes. She gets to learn from them. She gets to suffer for them. She gets to be celebrated for her successes. She gets to sometimes be punished for her successes. It pulls no punches in a way that really benefits the character and benefits the story.
Yeah, it's a good show.
But I have not seen Avatar or Korra.
Yeah, I don't think she's my favorite character, but she's definitely top.
Yeah,
probably Willow, Giles. I don't know which one I like more, and then her.
Yeah, yeah. My top five, because of course I made a spreadsheet. Drusilla, going from 5 to 1: Drusilla, Giles, Cordelia, Willow, Buffy, and then there's a bunch of later characters that are after Drusilla, but I will not talk about them, particularly because one of them is a huge spoiler.
Cordelia,
I love Cordelia. I'll be interested to get your take on Cordelia, especially if we end up doing another like later season episode. I guess she does get better in season 3 a little bit, but I think I like that archetype more than I think you do. And I definitely like, she became one of my favorite characters in season 2. So if you're still not on the, if you're still on the fence with her, it's probably not going to get much better.
Yeah. I think something that I push back against is kind of the inception of Cordelia in season 1, you know, is this Valley Girl antagonist in high school, right? Who's bullying them. And then she just immediately kind of jumps into being their friend and buddy. I feel like maybe I push less against her character and more about that kind of jump that she had, which I honestly think for this kind of show, I probably shouldn't have that high of, I don't want to say expectations, because it's like not necessarily a bad thing since it's so campy and so kind of free flowing with a lot of its internal logic. But I think it's mainly that factor is what I push back more against than her character, you know? And it's kind of jarring to see her to be one of the good guys when she was one of the bad guys immediately beforehand.
I think that's a fair critique. And I think in particular to your point around, oh, this show's fast and loose with logic. I mean, it's a show about vampires in suburban California. I think, though, that there's the difference between the kinds of it's a show that can play fast and loose with the logic of that part of the heightened world, but it is a show, especially as you get into season 2, that like asks you to invest more in the reality of these characters. And so if it's a thing like that Cordelia thing where it's like, that sounds like it's more that it's pushing you off because it feels fake for the relationship and fake for the characters so far, as opposed to the kind of thing that it's like, oh, this is weird, but it's the kind of weird that you can chalk up to. It's a weird show. Actually, on that point, the single most brilliant thing that this show did was the having the concept of the Hellmouth in Sunnydale, because almost every episode, there'll be some moment when I say, that's crazy. Why would they happen to run into Buffy? Why would there be like another person here? Why would it be like, wait, and now there's this kind of demon or whatever? And then immediately, as soon as I have that thought, I think, well, they are literally on a Hellmouth. And the whole point of the Hellmouth is that it attracts all this crazy evil constantly.
Yeah.
Big props to whoever came up with that concept.
Yeah.
It's a great get out of jail free card.
It's fantastic. And that's not the point of the show. You know,
yeah,
logic isn't something that should be. It's not a hard sci-fi TV show. It's about having fun.
Exactly. That is certainly true. But yeah, it is unsurprising that a TV show set in high school about high school drama, but also horror and through the trappings of particularly gothic horror, is a show that I love more than almost anything else I've watched in years. Because if you've listened to any episodes of the Made Up Club so far, you know that I love teen drama and I love horror. So here we go.
Yeah.
And I love Joss Whedon's work, even if I have qualms about him as a person.
Yes. Yeah. Unfortunately.
Anything else on the world of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Alex Wade?
I don't think so. How about you?
I think that's everything. I'm going to pull another Bryn and say, Benina, as my friend who cares the most about Buffy and has texted me the most about Buffy while I've been watching it, if you have any thoughts about Buffy that you want to send in, and unlike Bryn, you actually do it, but you also don't listen to this podcast, so you probably won't, you will also get free reign for me to post any thoughts you have on Buffy the Vampire Slayer in whatever our next episode of the podcast is. So,
yeah.
Take me up on that offer, please. If you have thoughts about Buffy the Vampire Slayer, I make no promises as to whether or not I will put them in the show. But I don't know, if you'd like send us an email or something and we like it, then we can certainly read and respond to it, because I don't know. Why not? But you can do that at theawclub@gmail.com. That's theawclub@gmail.com. You can also follow us on Twitter. Oh, that was one other thing. I kept a long-running Twitter thread as I was watching Buffy. And in retrospect, I should have done it on the AW Club account instead of on my private locked account where you cannot read it. But it is like 500 tweets about Buffy of all seven seasons that I watched through. So, but anyway, follow our podcast account that is not locked at the AW Club. That's theawclub. You can find our website at theadub.club, theadub.club. You can also find our topics guide, which is a list of all of the different things that we talk about. And if you want to click on those, you can find the episodes where we discuss those. So click on Buffy the Vampire Slayer or Cabin in the Woods, and you will be taken to this episode. And you can also, of course, find the podcast and subscribe to it wherever podcasts are found, be that iTunes, which is actually called Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. And that is finally everything.
AW Club out.
AW Club out.
I saw some random clip on Facebook. I don't know what season it was from, but it was like Willow had a completely new haircut and like she was so confident and like bold. I was like, this is not the Willow that I know.
Yeah. Keep watching the television program, Buffy the Vampire Slayer. God, Willow.
I'm not sure. Like,
keep watching the television program, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and you will find the answers to all of your questions.
I will, but I don't know if she's gay or not because she was talking to a woman and it seemed like it was a relationship or something. Maybe I was just pulling some out of my ass. Don't tell me, but you know, whatever. It was like, that's crazy.
I'm sworn to silence.